And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy hump day, Melody.
Yes, I'll tell you what, this week, it seems like we've had 2 weeks in this week already. Kind of like the month of March. Well, seemed like March was 3 years, but anyway, I guess to some degree that's good. You can get more done in that type of a week, or you're getting more done, I should say. We have a great program scheduled for today. We have Wendy Wilson joining us here right after the market report, and we got a lot of topics to talk about financially after in the second and third segment today. So let's go ahead and get started, and let's take a peek at the silver markets. And you know, it seems like it might have been a discouraging day, but it's a great buying day for gold and silver. Gold was down 27 bucks at 1700, still holding that level. Silver was down 38 cents at $17.82. Platinum was down 12 at 828. Palladium was up 4 at 2017. The USDX today is interesting, that was down 0.46 at 97.21. So I would say today would be a really good buying opportunity, because if that dollar stays down overnight, I would expect a big pop in the gold pricing tomorrow. Crude oil was up 8 cents today at 36.89. And for another one of those absolutely no reason that I could find, you have the paper markets who did really well today. You have the Dow up 527 points up 527 points at 26,269. That was up a little over 2%. The NASDAQ was up 74 at 9,682. The S&P was up 42 at 3,122. 10-year yield, 0.76. That was up 0.08. That's a big pop in the 10-year yield, considering what we've seen here of late. Let's see what else is going on. Of course, all the Asian and European markets, Germany was up almost 4%. London was up. I mean, Dave, we'll talk about this when we come back from the break, but my question to you now, so you have something to think about in these 20 minutes, is why? Other than government buying. So I don't recall seeing any type of news that would really increase the numbers that we've seen. So with that in everyone's mind, we have Wendy Wilson joining us with from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy. Well, we were having a little bit of technical problems with Wendy. We can't hear her. We did briefly, and I don't know if she can hear us. It shows that she's connected. Mm-mm-mm. So while that that is going on, and that, yeah, she can hear us. Todd, I don't know if you can just call her by the phone. It's a little bit easier to mess with her stuff. So in the meantime, well, Dave, I'm going to ask you that question. Why did the stock market go up 600 points today? Any particular reason?
Well, I think a combination. Certainly, I think some investors saw the jobless numbers, which we'll talk about in the second segment, as good news. That a loss of almost 3 million jobs was better than a loss of over 8 million, which economists had been expecting. So I think that was one of the big ones that drove the market, particularly earlier in the day. And then momentum continued. Whether or not it had anything to do with increased optimism of a COVID-19 vaccine. There's talk now by Dr. Fauci of a vaccine being available in the United States anyway by early January. That'd be a lot earlier than what it normally takes for a pandemic like a vaccine. So I think those two combined are driving. I'm sure there's certainly other factors. We have a story in the next segment that addresses just this issue, that is the dichotomy between the stock market and the quote real economy, and how disconnected they are from one another.
It truly is. I think we have Wendy by telephone now. Can you hear us now, Wendy?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. Welcome.
Awesome. Well, thank you. So sorry, I don't know what technology is doing today, but I thought we would talk about some of the errors of margin, which may play into what Dave, hello, Dave. Dave is just saying.
Hi, how are you?
It drives the market. And because, you know, humans are imperfect, as you know, and it is scientifically proven that a lot of the medical tests, including this COVID-19 test that we see, so many of them coming out, they have an error margin built into them. So a lot of medical professionals rather not talk about the error margin with these tests. But in general, for a rule of thumb, most medical tests have a 20% error margin built into them. So errors that are ignored or covered up in the medical studies will compound the error margin. And sadly, even your medical professionals are using tests that they're unaware that the test is flawed. So we're going to take a closer look at the importance of accurate tests, if they truly exist. What do you think?
Well, I think that
sounds worthy.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, here's something from the U.S. National Library of Medicine Institute of Health. It was a report that they titled "To Err is Human." It was published in April 1999. They say clinicians do not like dealing with errors despite the importance of recognizing and minimizing errors in the clinical practice. It's clear even the worst medical error might be preventable. Now, there was a study recently, April 2020, U.S. National Library of Medicine Institute of Health reported on some findings regarding medical errors, and they are stating that as many as 98,000 people die annually and needlessly due to a lot of preventable medical errors. That is the equivalent of a national disaster every week of every year. What do you think of that?
Wow, that's amazing.
Now, over a decade later, really nothing has changed, and the Consumers Union released a report also stating that within the 10 years when nothing changed, a million lives were lost and billions of dollars were wasted. And that was in a 2010 report. And then in May 2016, it was estimated we have over 251,000 deaths that occur annually. So here's a statement from the Scientific American from 2016. They said in 2014, a study estimated that diagnostic errors happen about 12 million times per year in the United States for outpatients alone. This equals 1 in 20 adults. That's a lot of people. Also, Institute of Medicine says diagnostic error in medicine are more common than you may think. These results routinely guide therapeutic decisions. And the Institute of Medicine goes on to say it is a misrepresentation that diagnostic laboratory tests are always correct and useful, although the primary tenet is to test no test performs perfectly. So we have to not put all our trust and faith in these tests because there is an error of margin. Now, there's two areas of medicine where this highly impacts patients. So the question is medicine really standardized as we have been led to believe? The answer is no. Medical science is not controlled because of research errors and cover-ups. So corruption keeps medicine from being that which is promoted to be. So the errors in medical research are largely underestimated. And one medical researcher said he thought more than half of the medical studies were fraudulent. And according to the United States National Library of Medicine Institute of Health, they have a report and they say there are two areas of medicine in which research impacts patients in a negative way, and those areas are laboratory medicine and radiology. So these two areas play a major role in diagnostics. So the wrong diagnosis and treatment plan often will kill the patient. That's a huge statement, isn't it?
Sure is.
So how wrong can a diagnosis be? Well, let us count the ways. They can miss the diagnosis and not identify the disease at all, or they can give you the wrong diagnosis where they've identified the wrong disease, or they can have a delayed diagnosis and it puts the doctor on the wrong path with a lot of flawed tests, and you're burning daylight when maybe time is of the essence. So kind of sounds like a whole lot can go wrong right from the start, and patients are paying a whole lot of money, and that money is non-refundable. So with medical cover-ups, it's really difficult to truly determine definitely the diagnosis error margin. Now, the estimates one study suggested was 3 to 5% of the errors regarding radiological interpretations by radiologists, and then also on the laboratory errors, they estimated 1 in every 300 to 1,000 events. So with your lab errors, figure one patient for every 900 lab results is incorrect. However, these are most likely underestimated numbers. So there's a lot that goes unreported in your clinical settings. So, you know, the lab reports and the study reports are pretty inaccurate, and this translates into the wrong diagnosis and the wrong treatment plans in many cases. And then also you have to factor in hospital policy. Why do you suppose the errors go unreported? Do you have any clue?
Well, yeah, I mean,
liability concerns.
Hospitals for profit. Hospitals for profit.
Yeah, well, often it stems from their clinical policy. Hospital policy is supposed to be set up to determine how often mistakes occur. And there is also supposed to be policy to improve on those mistakes that often do occur. So hospital assessments, when they're done on a hospital from a third party, they usually produce reports where staff disregard many of the policies and procedures that are already in place. And one common trend within medicine is that if a mistake did not cause a significant harm, then it is not even looked into to prevent it from recurring again. So all these things point to a poor standardization within medicine, and your lab errors are so common that samples can be placed in the wrong container and you get a lot of patient mix-ups. Here's a quote from the Institute of Medicine. They say, using the right test is critical to obtaining desired information. Inappropriate utilization of lab testing is a significant problem. One test can often be performed multiple ways and not always equal, as in the case of testing, for instance, Zika virus. So if there's more than one way to run the test, you're going to get different results each time it's run. The Institute of Medicine says mistakes made prior to the samples being tested also account for 70% of the lab-related errors. So they can actually contaminate a sample before it's even tested. And to give you an example, Shannon Heyman, she's a physician, she's a lab director at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. She says she has received lab samples in Gatorade bottles.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and we often want to think, you know, our medical professionals are on the ball and they do things by the book, but that's not the case. That's just not the case. I've worked in hospitals. I've known a lot of people that have worked in hospitals, and a lot of times you'd be shocked at some of the slipshod, you know, procedures and behavior going on. Now, patients also should look at specific questions about tests. They should have some sort of understanding about the test and ask what the results are, what they mean. Often tests will give you a range of normal limits in which the results fall in between to determine severity. So is the test vetting? Has it been vetted and has it been in use for a while? Or is it an experimental test? These are questions patients should find out. Always do not... you always want to do your homework on these tests. And with this in mind, when you get new tests, especially tests that are rushed or hastily rushed into market, they're going to most often offer and produce the highest error margins because they haven't been vetted yet. So research and test your research on your test. You can look that up online. You can learn as much as you can about the results and what they mean. And always ask your physician, what is the error margin for that particular test, and how often has he or she found the test to be inaccurate? So if your physician tells you they've never been wrong, that's statistically impossible. Okay? So when in doubt, get a second opinion, get a second run on the test, and you may even want to compare results with different tests if your doctor's using different tests. And, you know, statistically, tests cannot be 100% accurate all the time. It's impossible. So always investigate is what I tell people. Investigate. If you're getting a diagnosis, and that's the beginning of an investigation, basically, into what may be wrong or what could be the cause. So it can help you, point you in the right direction, or what it may reveal what's really the cause and what's really wrong, and you may be able to reverse your condition if you have that understanding. So diagnostic tools and your lab test and your radiological test are just tools, and we hope they are used appropriately. However, humans make mistakes, and in some instances, the creation of these tests, these diagnostic tests, could be flawed and produce even the wrong results. So rule of thumb is always a 20% error margin. So if you go in knowing that, and you'll be able to make some great decisions on what to ask your doctor when you go get tested.
You know, it is amazing though, Wendy, when you go get a test, you know, it's just amazing how much time they waste. And of course it's all dollar related, and mm-hmm. I would think it'd be a great position job to have medical advocates who really fight for a patient. I know, I'm sure there's some out there, but probably not enough. And difficult to find in areas, but it's a challenge to get second tests.
It is, but you know, we shouldn't put all our faith in the test. Is the point?
Absolutely not.
And always get a second opinion if you need one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's because you know, doctors will always stick up for one another. You know, even if one did something wrong. Well, you know, that's just the way he views things. Well, anyway, give us some contact information.
Yeah, and don't be afraid to ask questions is another thing. Don't be afraid to be intimidated and not ask. Always ask. 866-229-3663 is our phone number at Apothecary Herbs, 866-229-3663. And, of course, on the web, thepowerherbs.com. Always great to be with you guys.
Thank you, Wendy. Get that technical stuff fixed. I'm just kidding.
I know.
We have it here all the time. Thank you, Wendy, and she'll be joining us once again next Wednesday, so make sure you tune in again for Wendy Wilson at Apothecary Herbs. We'll be back in just a few short minutes. Thank you for your listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. And, you know, we're... It must be something with Skype that where there's some technology problems. So we're trying to get Dave back on the line. But I'm going to go ahead and we're going to talk about the 2.5 million jobs that have been shed. And this is a positive number. Positive news is how it is being touted. In the loss of another 3 million jobs, it isn't too easy to do it, but the steep drop in private payrolls for May could be a sign that maybe the worst is over. ADP today reported that companies had shed another 2.8 million positions last month. Under normal circumstances, that you'd think that number would be considered catastrophic, but I guess we're not living in normal times. A count that was well below the 8.75 million estimate. That was what they were estimating, provided that the most severe job crisis in the U.S. history is about to turn around as an economy has been battered by the virus. Whether that hope is justified or false remains to be seen in the coming weeks and months. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said that the good news is he thinks the recession is over. The COVID-19 recession is over. Barring another second wave, a major second wave, or real serious policy areas. How can they think that the recession is over? How can it be over? I don't care if they were expecting an 8.75 million estimate for the account, and they only got 2.8, and that's happy news? Ask the 2.8 million if those positions will ever be reopened. And the whole 30 million prior to that. It's like, good grief. The recession is over? With reports that the economy won't turn around for 10 years? But if we cut that in half and say even 5 years. What do you think is going to happen in 5 years on the road that we're on? And we do know that the ADP count is volatile, and certainly it does vary widely from the government numbers that we'll see on Friday. But one is that the last week's jobless claims report provided the first indications that the pace of layoffs also have slowed notably, but it was still kind of a hefty number. I don't know if we have Dave on the line yet. So maybe they're going to have to hang up and call him too and do it by phone. All righty, thank you. But the continuing claims are those workers receiving unemployment benefits for at least 2 weeks tumbled by nearly 3.9 million, even as the first-time claims numbered more than 2.1. You know, I guess it's something like the glass half full or half empty. Continuing claims peaked at 24.9 million on May, and I think we have Dave. We got
Can you hear
Dave.
Me?
I can.
Hey, there's good news.
Yes, we can hear you now. I was just talking about the continuing claims that peaked at 24.9 million on May 9th, but that was the 3 days before the sample week that both ADP and the Labor Department use for their estimates.
Well, it looks as though our good buddy Mark Zandi, just another paper market enabler, with his comments that the recession is over. Perhaps he was being, well, I don't think he'd be tongue-in-cheek, but maybe he was saying, you know, the worst is over. But words matter, Mark, and some of us watch pretty closely. In any event, he did say that he expects the unemployment rate to top out above 20%, and that'll be reported on Friday. It's the worst since the Great Depression. He estimated that 50 million American workers have been impacted in some ways by this current recession. Even at an initial reading of 20.5 million, the government's estimate for April probably undercounted the total because of a tabulation discrepancy where millions of workers who had been classified as, quote, absent from work actually should have been considered unemployed. Excuse me. As we've told you, the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimated that 14.7% headline unemployment rate would have been nearly 5 percentage points higher had those workers been counted correctly. Zandi said, in any event, the job loss is abating. Layoffs appear to have peaked. This is him now. Layoffs appear to have peaked in late March and early April and winding down by early May. I would expect job growth to resume in June. I would say good luck with that, Melody. He also projected that unemployment likely will level off at around 10%, which happened to be the Great Recession peak, and stay there until Congress approves more fiscal stimulus.
You know, it's interesting because they say job growth. I wouldn't consider people returning to their work as job growth. I mean, there's no growth in this economy. It's just people, you know, are being able to go back to work. And hopefully there's work there for them to do.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's, again, how everything is just presented to make people feel good, to make think that, you know, we're going to have this some kind of a, you know, V-shape recovery. Hey, I wish we would. I really do. That would be awesome. But I just can't imagine us being back to where we were. I mean, we were already talking about the cracks in our economy, how the numbers were being skewed, so the real numbers weren't being reported. We had the repo market in trouble since September. On our earlier program today, Dave, I says, well, you know, things happen in threes. We have the virus. We have the riots. There's another one coming, ladies and gentlemen. So we're not quite sure what it is yet, but I have a feeling it's going to be attached to the economy. Because although, you know, we've been hearing about major, major hurricane season.
Oh, yes.
So there's all kinds of, which is only going to add to the state's financial problems. What do you think it's costing these states with these riots? They're already ready to go begging for money from the federal government. So, and here's an area, Dave. The U.S. services industry activity pushed off an 11-year low in May. But, you know, as we've said, you know, for the past how many months, businesses appear in no rush to rehire workers as they reopen. And that's supporting views the economy, it could take years to recover. The Institute for Supply Management said today that its non-manufacturing activity index rose to a reading of 45.4 last month from 41.8 in April, which was the lowest since March of 2009 and the first contraction since December of 2009. A reading below 50, of course, indicates contractions in the services sector. And that accounts for more than two-thirds of the U.S. economic activity. And economists had forecast the index increasing to reading a 44 in May. So, of course, this report came on the heels of the ISM's manufacturing survey on Monday, showing factory activity easing off an 11-year low in May. But how much did it really ease off? The economy contracted at a 5% annualized rate in the first quarter, and this is the worst performance since the 2007-09 recession. And time and time again, we've been hearing about the GDP is expected to decline at a rate of over 40% in the second quarter, which would be the biggest contraction in output since the Great Depression of the 30s. So, Dave, the list goes on and on and on.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the ISM survey of new orders for the services industry again increased to a reading of about 42. That was up fairly significantly from 32.9 in April, which had been the weakest since the series started in 1997. And the survey's index of services industry employment also edged up, although much more slightly, 31.8 last month from 30.0 in April, again the lowest since 1997. Obviously, that points to distress in the labor market, which is expected to be, again, underscored by the government's employment report for May coming out Friday morning. So we will see. The headline unemployment rate is forecast to skyrocket from 14.7% to 19.7%, which would be a post-World War II high. John Williams of ShadowStats.com believes the actual unemployment rate is already in excess of 35%. So depends on who you trust, what you believe in. We'll keep reporting, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I'm not one to trust the government numbers, you know, and they come blatantly out and say, you know, hey, try to hide some of those unemployment numbers, don't report everything, drag them out and so forth, because we don't want to show how bad it really is. And the thing of it is, we are going to get some sort of a show of a recovery. I mean, my gosh, when you have, what, 40 million people out of work and you come back, you know, and the economy's businesses go back to work, yeah, people are going to come back to work. And the big question, I guess, today then, Dave, is just really how far do we come back? You know, how much do we come back? But they will spin it that, you know, that everything is fine. We'll have the greatest economy in the history of this country, even if the unemployment drops, if we use government numbers, from 19 back to 14 back to 10. It'll be the greatest economy ever. So, and I'm grateful that all these people will be able to go back to work. So again, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it's going to be an easy peasy type of recovery, because we have too many things that just the foundation isn't there. And who knows? No one's talking about what the Fed's doing, all the stimulus. Whatever recovery that we see is all going to be based on stimulus once again, just like in 2008, 9, 10, 11. So, talking about the V recovery, Fed economists said that, I think it was the St. Louis Fed economist says you're going to have to go to negative interest rates in order to have a strong V-shaped growth recovery. Negative rates. Many economists dismiss the likelihood of the current record-breaking slump being followed by an equally aggressive recovery. St. Louis Fed economist Yi Wen said in a paper that achieving that kind of a rebound is necessary and possible, but is using aggressive stimulus even beyond what authorities deployed during the Great Recession. And that could include taking interest rates below zero. Wen compared the response to two major U.S. economic downturns, of course, the Great Depression and, of course, the 2008 financial crisis. And he found that the use of aggressive fiscal response through FDR's New Deal helped generate that recovery after the Depression. On the other hand, primarily monetary responses like low interest rates and Fed asset purchases during the Great Recession produced an L-shaped recovery in which GDP failed to reach potential. And remember, the only way that the FDR had the New Deal during the Great Depression is because what they had to do, they had to take us off the gold standard. They confiscated gold. That was part of it, because those programs could not have been created, because gold led to accountability. Sure, they could go into debt and so forth, but there was a limit to what they could do. Take us off, confiscate gold, and there you go. And here we are today. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars are being funneled into these financial markets. And billions of dollars are being made off of it. And the poor guy who hopes to retire with this retirement account and pension account, his dollars are purchasing less and less every single day. And he's the one that will pay for the recklessness of what is being done just to keep it going. And I mean, Dave, it really is. And everybody knows we're going into negative interest rates, because they're going to take it as far as they can. That's the next step. And when you think of negative interest rates, and I've been saying this for years, since negative interest rates became a popular tool in Europe and everywhere else, that's a sign of a healthy economy, isn't it? But
well, this is an interesting development, especially coming on the heels of Jerome Powell and other members of the Fed board saying that we don't think negative interest rates an appropriate tool here in the U.S. And now a senior economist in a paper in one of the Fed branches, I mean, he's not necessarily supporting it, although he's saying his research suggests that negative interest rates are going to be required, essentially, for a V-shaped recovery. So a combination of policies will be needed so the U.S. can generate what he calls an S-shaped pattern, where growth starts slowly and then quickly bursts higher. And he said without it, the economic consequences of the pandemic will be permanent. So that's, again, I think that's a very interesting development coming on the heels. In fact, this paper, I think, could now pave the way, give the Fed policymakers an out for taking interest rates below zero.
Sure, it's all staged. It's, you know, information is released, statements are released. It's what they say. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. We were just talking about negative rates, and during the break, we were talking about everything that the Fed is doing, and no one is talking about it. The only thing that you hear anyone talk about is low rates and negative rates. No one's talking about all the what the Fed is doing is to keep the system going. It really is. Even in 2008, the Great Recession of 2008, when the programs were being created, everybody talked about them. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, not a peep. Mm-hmm. Except, oh, is he going to raise rates, or is he going to keep them the same, or are we going negative? And that's all. It's really amazing. And the unemployment, you know, that's the only barometer. And the stock market, that's what equals that we're staying together. It seems like that's the only thing that's important. And nothing else matters. And it's like nothing else has any impact yet. And I say yet. So I don't know if there's anything else to say about that, Dave.
No.
All right.
I don't think so.
Well, you know, we talk about Joseph Stiglitz every once in a while. And speaking of stimulus programs, he says, although they're designed to keep the economy afloat during downturns, they failed to provide real relief to American workers and companies who need it the most. And, you know, and I mean, that's just, you know, that goes without saying. He says the problem wasn't just the amount of money. It was how the programs were designed. Our programs have failed. And we have to admit that. Since early March, the federal government has authorized nearly $3 trillion in stimulus to assist the ailing economy. Stiglitz says the PPP program, which allocated hundreds of billions of dollars in loans to small businesses, was particularly badly designed. The businesses, and Dave, I heard there's still like, what, a third of the money that's not even been dished out yet?
Yeah.
The businesses with the best connections with the banks, the best customers, got at the head of the line. And I remember talking about that. And those weren't the smallest businesses. You had to know somebody. They weren't the people who needed it the most. With more than 40 million Americans out of work, Stiglitz warned that the economy recovery is not going to be easy. He said the fiscal programs in other countries like Denmark, New Zealand, which have paid companies to keep workers on their payroll, serve as a better models on how to tackle unemployment. But that's more socialism, though, from coming from those countries, which have their own problems, Dave.
Well, Stiglitz added, we just haven't thought enough about how we get money to the businesses in ways that make sure they really keep the attachment to the workers with those businesses. He's a professor at Columbia University, saying that Congress should prioritize policies that assist recent high school and college graduates. Otherwise, he said, the U.S. risks facing a lost generation of workers. The unemployment rate for workers with only a high school degree surged from 4.4% in March to 17.3% in April, again, according to the government. And as we just mentioned, economists expect jobless data on Friday will show a further spike in unemployment in May as many businesses remain shut. Stiglitz said every young person should be either in school, on a job, or in training in some way. These are valuable years, he added. You shouldn't be wasting those years feeling disconnected or resentful. So I would put really a high priority on that kind of program. Mm. That comes from Joseph Stiglitz, former Nobel Peace Prize winner in economics.
Wow. Interesting. I like some of his stuff, you know, that he writes, and you know, who am I to question a to question his Nobel Prize winning
his intellect.
Yes, but you know, sometimes intellect also needs to have some common sense.
Yeah, sometimes and, we need to bring him down from below the sky, the clouds. Excuse me.
But you know what? What I don't think it would ever, no one is planning on. You know, we talk about, and I do believe job training. I mean, it is different now than it was when we went to, you know, when we were getting out of high school and so forth. And what's going to happen when technology and the robots take over? I mean, what's going to happen to, you know, we're talking about job losses based on the virus, and you know, we're at, you know, John Williams shadow stats, 30%, 35% unemployment.
Yeah, we're going to have to be reading a whole lot of books at our at the homeless communes when the robots come.
Yeah, but I mean, that's jobs that aren't being created.
Oh,
you know, and people, exactly. You know, and people want to, people want to say, how do we address the problems that we have now? You know, in you know, well, people need jobs, and it's, you know, it's.
I think a big part of the disconnect, and we don't want to spend too much time on that this diversion, but, and we talk about it off and on this program is. Not just the disconnect between the stock market and the real economy, but between a future with robots versus a future with, you know, humans with jobs. I mean, think about that. The disconnect in particularly public companies being driven by, you know, their zest, their zeal to please the stockholders, the stakeholders. And what's that going to result in? That's going to result, I mean, we're already on that slope. And if we don't watch out, you know, this 25%, 35% figure, I mean, that could become systemic and long-term.
Agreed. But and any manufacturing that moves back here for whatever reason, I don't believe it's going to be in anything meaningful. You're going to have some. But what, you don't, either it's going to be new factories, they're going to retool everything that's already here if they take something out, and it's going to be all technology. And there's a lot of people that won't qualify for,
yeah,
the jobs that they do present.
Yeah. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
So these people that don't qualify for those upper positions are in the same boat as they are today. And it's tough, and no one's addressing it.
Yeah. I'm afraid the value of a liberal arts education
ain't gonna cut it
as it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s is very quickly going to become a thing of the past.
Sure.
But I mean, colleges, there's universities that survive.
But there's folks who couldn't get to those colleges that used to go and have manufacturing jobs, so that provided a good income and benefits and a future, you know, where people work for 30, 40, 50 years at one place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's never coming back, ever. So let's go ahead and move on to the Levity is Golden segment, Dave. And I don't know where you found this, but it's very interesting. So tell us what the topic is.
My sources are secret. But it's a short one today, ladies and gentlemen, but fascinating nevertheless. the last person to receive a pension from the U.S. Civil War, ended in 1865, has died at the age of 90. Irene Triplett, who's the daughter of a Civil War veteran by the name of Mosey Triplett, died Sunday in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, following complications after a surgery. According to one mainstream news outlet, she received a pension of $73.13 a month from the Department of Veteran Affairs for her father's service, which began more than 155 years ago. Wow, that's amazing. According to this newspaper, Private Triplett, her father, enlisted in the Confederate 53rd North Carolina Infantry Regiment in May of 1862 before defecting to a Union regiment 2 years later. In 1924, when he was 83 years old, he married 34-year-old Elida Hall.
Shame on him.
Ay, ay, ay. And the two of them had Irene. Mosey, the father, died at the age of 92 in 1938. So, now, it's said that Irene Triplett lived a tough life. As a child, she reportedly was beaten by her parents and her teachers alike. And after her father died, she and her mother lived several years in the Wilkes County, North Carolina, poorhouse. Medicaid and her small Civil War-era pension helped pay for her residence in care homes throughout the years. Melody, who knew that Civil War pensions were still being paid early in the 21st century? Well, in any event, R.I.P. to Irene Triplett. You've earned an eternity of rest. And that is this week's Levity is Golden.
That really is interesting. Who would have thought?
How about it? Gosh.
Wow. 155 years ago. Anyway, thanks. That was very interesting, Dave.
Hey, anytime.
And, yeah, you know, something of my favorite interest, of course, is gold. And we had a little bit of a pullback today, but we've both seen gold and silver continue to rise. And I mean, we all know the gold is a safe haven, and it's moving, you know, it is moving right along with the equity markets. The dollar has got shown some weakness, and, you know, like I said, if the dollar is weak once again tomorrow, I would think gold should have a pretty nice turnaround. But or is it really a shock to see gold prices with an upside bias right now as investors bid up these equities? Granite Share CEO Will Ryan said both asset classes are responding well to the fiscal and monetary stimulus programs that have been put out since the COVID-19 crisis in March. He says it's the same exact playbook that we saw in 2008, when after the financial crisis, we saw similar extremely high levels of stimulus put into the market, which benefited both the stock market and gold. Spot gold prices rose slightly yesterday to more than $1,750 an ounce. You know, again, it was down a little bit, you know, $20, $30 today. The correction alone makes it an excellent buying opportunity. And although an ETF investor took profits after the ISM showed a surprising return in the non-manufacturing sector, gold has skyrocketed by over 17% over the past 6 months. So is that why we saw a little bit of the gold drop today? The ETF investor took profits?
Yeah, that's what I read mid-afternoon. And that certainly does make sense, particularly you know, with the upward momentum on gold being so strong, some of these fly-by-nighters, particularly ETF owners, paper gold owners, tend to get in and out a lot more often than owners of bullion and coins. So we'll see. This guy Rind thinks the gold rally has a lot of legs left, we agree. He said you go all the way back to 1980, which was the previous high in gold before the high we reached in 2011. 1980 gold prices reached about $800 an ounce. So adjusted for inflation, that price is worth about $2,500 today. Obviously, $1,700 significantly below that level. If you look, if you look at the all-time high for gold, we're nowhere near that today. So he says from that perspective, gold is not like other asset classes that are trading at or near all-time highs, i.e. stocks. In short, ladies and gentlemen, gold is going to keep on rising. And as Melody said earlier, with today's correction, it's a great buying opportunity. So when you're ready to add more to your portfolio, you know the number, 1-800-375-4188.
And again, I just want to briefly touch on, we have Gold Eagles available, and I am beginning to see the premiums drop a little. Oh, we're out of time. My goodness, Dave, where did it go? Yeah. I still wanted to talk.
Well, I guess we can. Just people aren't going to hear us until tomorrow.
I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us today. And as Dave said, we will be back tomorrow. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye. That's too bad.